So I was just asked this morning to provide a discussion. So I may rely on Chris Fryer here, who has thought a lot more about the issues that were discussed this morning, but didn't actually see the talk. So we're sort of, you know, my ears, his eyes, sort of thing. So yeah. So I don't know. I also wanted to spend a little time on an alternative ideas for we haven't talked about yet, which are formation and AGN disk. Barry McKernan's going to say a little bit about that maybe halfway through the discussion. But before that, I just wanted to sort of raise some general points, and I'm hoping that the discussion will just sort of take over. We've already, you know, heard a lot of discussion of the homogeneous evolution channel from Stan today. We heard about massive star evolution connection to parent stability supernova. And so we've already addressed some of the ways we could distinguish these models or points of tension. And so I wanted to just start off by reminding people of a few things at rates. Now, I forget what exactly our LIGO rate range was. It's 9 to 200, 240, okay. So our binary black hole rate detected from LIGO is something like that. So today, Stan was talking about various channels of parent stability, which are one, pulsational parent stability is one mechanism. Actually, also parent stability for getting very luminous supernovas. So I also put up the measured rate of the so-called superluminous supernova, not all of which are probably parent stabilities, but that sort of gives you an idea. And that rate actually turns out to be sort of comparable at redshift one. Yeah, sorry. I should have put normal supernova up here. So let's put them here. So normal supernova would be something like 10 to the 5. Okay, so that's an enormous rate. If we restrict ourselves to this rare class of very bright supernova, I'd actually maybe some other people are on this. This is from PRAS 2016. I don't remember if this includes the hydrogen poor ones or both classes of the superluminous supernova, the ones with and without stripped envelopes, but these are just the hydrogen poor ones, okay. Then the other rate I wanted to throw up here just as we start thinking about things is the local long GRB rate. The observed one is about 0.3 per gigaparsec cubed. We don't know very well. We have some idea what the opening angles of long gamma ray bursts are from modeling their afterglows. Typically, the beaming correction people is now in vogue is about 50 or 100, so the opening angle of about, say, 5 or 10 degrees. So that corrects you up by about a factor of 100. So locally, the true rate of long GRBs is something like 30. It may be somewhat higher if you include the low luminosity, quote-unquote, low luminosity GRBs, which appear to be less energetic but maybe more volumetrically prevalent. And then if you go to higher redshift, the GRB rate sort of traces the star formation rate. So this goes up by at least a factor of 10. So probably if we're talking about the binaries that are forming at high redshift, we're dealing with an observed rate of 3 or a true rate of about 300. Okay. So if we were at the high end of the LIGO black hole rate, then that would basically require that every black hole that formed, I mean, well, obviously, not all the black holes have to make GRBs, but that would be sort of if we.
So not all black holes make GRBs,
Right.
but not all GRBs make black holes.
Sure. So it's not exactly a fair comparison. We would really want to see the spinning, the fraction, the rate of the spinning black holes.
What's the universe rate? Is that a few cubes per second then?
Oh, I don't know in terms of the. Yeah, maybe this number, if it's 10 to the 5, this is the total supernova rate, 10 to the 5. I don't know what it is in terms of per second, all universe, but. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because I believe the ratios of the LGRBs might be a little small, maybe might be a little bit bigger, but I believe the ratios, but it's all normalized to the supernova rate.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so the other number I was going to, I don't know if anyone has a comment on this. The other number I thought was sort of interesting based on the morning discussion was Pablo's discussing the delay time distributions between the two supernova and the homogeneous models, and he was saying that it could be as short as 100 or 1,000 years typically. And that may be, if we think that the black holes in his systems are producing GRBs, that may start to be in tension with repeating GRBs. So for instance, if the delay time distribution is flat between, let's say, if it's sort of equal probability of them being separated by in time between zero time and 10 to the 3 years, then you would expect a delay less than 10 years in every, say, 100 binaries. And so if you had 2,000 gamma ray bursts detected by BATSE over a decade, you would expect, say, 20 or something to be of the repeating kind. Now, that's assuming that all the GRBs came through this channel. So maybe Pablo's not saying that, and only a fraction do, and maybe we're okay. I don't think there's any evidence for people have looked for repeating GRBs. That was a very hot topic in the 90s to see if they were repeating, and I don't think everyone found any evidence for that. Yeah?
I have a question on 100-year time scale.
Okay.
For discussion. First, I think if you had 100 and 100.01 solar mass stars, or even 200 solar mass stars, right, and when they died, they'd be different. That is, I don't believe the Russell vector. By the time you go through the different convective stages that finally lead up to the collapse, there's been noise in the system. The characteristic time scale that might be relevant is that from helium depletion until core collapses, 1 to 10,000 years. It's the Kelvin-Helmholtz time for the core to contract and ignite carbon burning, and carbon burns for maybe 100 years. So
okay.
I would be more comfortable with a 1,000-year window than 100.
Okay.
So close to, for the, well, okay, so when you say not to go, what do you believe in 1,000 years from close to the moon?
Yeah, which is a time scale we know from 87.
Okay, so maybe we're in the blue then. We're fine.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but applications, if these are basically,
it's still very close, but statistics, he was talking about a factor of 10 matters.
Right.
Is it 1,000 years of interest in terms of that the second one would run into a differently shaped ISM from the first?
Well, I mean, they're both going to look like wire lines too, right? But they will be different densities. So
yeah, I guess you would clear out, the first one would clear out a
when it runs into the shell.
Yeah, so you might expect but afterglows tend to get smoothed out even with bumpy media.
So the short GRB rate is about 10.
The local short GRB rate's about 10. Yeah, we don't know the Beeman correction. People might think it's smaller, so maybe the short GRB rate is 100.
I guess one thing that might be interesting would be if you get a better handle on the metallicity, right? I mean, crudely, you might expect the number of stars of metallicity is proportional to metallicity. Right? So the hundreds of solar metallicity is already knocking all the rates down by a factor. So if one's restricted to low metallicity, sort of comparing the supernova rates to everything else, you're already taking a big hit.
I mean, if you just considered the supernova rate of low metallicity.
Could you restrict the star formation to rate of less than a 20th of solar or 100th of solar? Or if you want primordial ones, even fewer.
Right, you need a much higher rate. Okay.
Yeah, that was something I didn't entirely understand about Pablo's. Understood correctly, you were still saying even at low metallicity, only one out of 1,000 supernovae produce a binary black hole. But
yeah, emerging
binary black hole at low metallicity.
That's right. So I kind of had the same question that Searle was getting at. So I take that 1,000 and then I take a fraction of stars that are at low metallicity. So it seems hard for me to get a big rate. Maybe I'm missing. It didn't seem to hang together. Because I take that 1,000 and then I take 10 or 100 for the mass of low metallicity. And the rate seems really low.
Well, you're essentially scaling the supernova rate.
Right.
So
just... No, but the supernovae, those are all solar metallicity. Exactly. What is the rate of supernova? There are hundreds of solar metallicity. It's probably 100 of that.
So that's exactly 10 to the 5 times 10 minus 3, which was your number, and then times 10 minus 2, which is the mass fraction, and I get to 1.
Yeah, in that case, you would be pushing it significantly down.
But the superluminous rate is already low metallicity. So.
Yeah.
Sterile, that's an interesting question. I didn't know. What's the average metallicity of the average supernova in the universe?
Yeah, well, really, the question is, what is the rate of supernovae as a function of metallicity or star formation?
Yes.
Local star formation rate or star formation.
Same thing. Is the average metallicity numerical of all supernova in the universe closer to solar or 10% solar?
Except that it's the ones that are only low metallicity in the higher redshift. So I think there's. Yeah.
Anything else anyone want to say about rates? Okay. I had a few provocative questions, because we were talking a little bit today about a fairly generic prediction of this gap and the black hole mass function. And we heard some discussion about what LIGO will be able to tell us about whether there's a low mass black hole gap, and I didn't. So I guess I have a few questions, provocative questions. Well, one is how well we're going to be able to determine the existence of this gap from LIGO. I think it would be fairly clear eventually. But what happens if we find black holes? I'm thinking of the high mass. Sorry. Parent stability. The parent stability supernova gap.
It's very ambitious to think you're going to see a gap. You're going to see an upper mass. You know, you see the 52 cutoff, but you're very unlikely to see. You'll see very few things above 130.
That was my feeling, and I asked someone today, and Pablo said you would see them.
This is the thing, is at least with Chris Botensky's results, the detection rate of these really these black holes where the gap would be is really low. So you have to observe a lot of black holes before his prediction is you shouldn't see anything for a long time up there, even if there wasn't a gap. So he did a simulation where he didn't have the gap, simulation where he did have the gap, and it would be hard to detect the difference.
So there's a cutoff.
So if you see one in the gap, then you have something. But if you don't see one, that doesn't tell you whether there's a gap or not.
But if when you talk with Truman envelope revolution, you're strongly constrained by the IMF. Because if you want a single star to have this huge inner core, then the initial mass needs to be very large.
So you're compounding. It's really, you know, we don't actually predict that many, even if we didn't believe in parent stable supernova, we would predict many observed.
That's the recent Belchinsky paper.
So what happens if we do? What happens if we detect a 70 solar mass black hole? Will it be that we have to add rotation to the parent stability models? Will it be?
Again, you can also repeat it.
I was about to say, is it indicative of?
You just say that if you see one, you say, it's not made by a simple field.
Well, I mean, the perfect scenario, right, would be you see a clear drop in the rates there, and then you can work out the relative difference between two. The problem is, at least for globulars, the rate, again, that we predict is roughly that same mass rate, it's tiny, it's like 0.1 megaparsec cube per year or less. Things mergers and galactic nuclei. We haven't done a full break calculation of that. So.
And it's in that framework within merger, we do not expect a non-trivial mass ratio.
Yeah, I mean after one or two. So I mean, the, as you build that up, of course, it becomes more and more likely that the relevance of K is going to eject from the cluster. So for most of these, you maybe see one merger in a cluster, and again, it means like a galactic nuclei. It's like a huge potential merger to keep it in there. So you might be able to build up one or two repeated mergers, and that's it.
But I guess it's important about these repeated mergers that they would be high spin.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad to be some.
Yeah, not just high spin, but if it turns out that all these black holes have low spins, then repeated mergers are high spins of 0.7.
Yeah, they'll build up.
Yeah. So I mean, if we see something in the gap with a misaligned spin of 0.7,
then we know that you know
it's that's where we are.
Yeah. So then if I can go through further mergers, can it push beyond those 0.9 or?
No, because each merger is 0.7. The remnants only have 0.8 grams of them, but that's the mass ratio, so they were already equal masses.
Oh, what if you have like a 0.7, 2.7 merge?
Well, that would say
a 9.
But then you get our measurement on this pin is going to be so large.
Well, but again,
because, I mean, we have very, very few cycles. It's all the old merger and ring down. And also, for us, I should say, well, the waveforms are not white, you know.
But the mass ratio is generated now. The mass ratio is generated now.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the measurements with the mass ratio again is going to be very important. So I can get total mass.
No, but for total mass like this,
you get the total mass.
You can measure a mass ratio of like 2:1, right?
Well, we'll yeah, it's very, it's going to be so degenerate with the spin there, the mass ratio, that I think you will have really a big uncertainty. I think the total mass.
But
would be great.
But total mass would be good enough.
So I think that is the key.
Given that the mass ratio is
yeah.
But that, well, there's some unattributed.
So, Pablo, in your models, what is the ratio of the rates? If there were no parents, abilities, is there going to be just a lot of ratio of the rates between, say, 30 and solar mass pairs?
I think it's a factor of 10, so the lower mass and more.
Oh, wait, those are observed rates or the. Observed rates are a factor of 10.
The volumetric rates are sort of a factor of 100, less than more massive ones, but because of the volume, you bring them closer together.
Yeah? I haven't, but. My second question, I mean, we can keep talking about this if you'd like, but my second question was sort of a little bit more crazy, which, okay, so imagine we establish that the maximum mass of a neutron star, right now it's above 2, maybe it's 2.2 or 2.3 or something, and we figure that out what that is, or close to what it is. And what happens if we detect a black hole? Can we detect a black hole confidently less than that? Yeah, exactly.
Because it's cool if you can do this, right? Because what it means is that we need to collapse. You have the equation to state that in normal collapses, we have a two solar mass neutron star. imagine that particular collapse, you didn't hit some phase transition in the equation of state and stayed a neutron star. But imagine that whatever the collapse was, say it had less angular momentum, it got, you know, higher densities, created a phase transition that for that, once it had the phase transition, the maximum mass is lower. So you could actually be probing something. So it is, I can think of a scenario with the equation of state where you make a 1.8 solar mass black hole, even though we've seen a 2 solar mass neutron star.
I think one signature is that you see electron. So that is a clean signature.
It's
going to be less than 1 second before you break up.
I mean, if you
neutral stars tend to be less than 0.7 because it breaks up for all reasons.
All right. You want to say something, Stan? All right, Stan. Stan has the floor.
Sufficient to the level of 0.1 uncertainty, or really 1.4. Yeah, so I mean, we get it from the install, right? So we can build up a lot of session samples.
You can basically tell curve all the support you will.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's also, the one reason why you want to spin is to say something about the spin of the star.
Well, the spin of the helium core, I mean, there's a lot of interest in that today. Helium size model.
But my other fear on that is, you know, the first black hole form is getting it spun up, there's an accretion, right? So do I worry about
that? And so it could, depending on how much it accretes. I thought that was about to be small.
Yeah, how much can we spin up a black hole to accretion?
Well, is it adding to planetary?
Then not much.
Yeah, please do that, I think it's one foot.
When it
happens, I'll load it.
All right, so I wanted to give Barry a chance to say something about an alternative channel. And maybe if we have some time, we can come back to a few other things. So he's going to provide sort of a discussion of an alternative dynamical-ish channel. Here, do you want this microphone?
Here.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've heard a lot about two main models for stellar mass black hole mergers at the meeting so far. I want to introduce you to model 2.1. So it's essentially the idea that what we're looking at are mergers of stellar mass black holes in AGN disks. So merger events in AGN disks. And I'm going to give you just a cartoon outline. I'll sort of raise some positive things about this model, some negative things about this model, and then hopefully provoke some discussion and get some people talking. If there's anything I forget, if both Brian and Savik can chime in, please sort of add to what I say. So the naive picture is take Carl's presentation. Okay, we've got loads of stars and stellar remnants in galactic nuclei. We've got a supermassive black hole right in the center. Add gas. Okay, so immediately make things a lot more complicated. Add a gas disk. So if you do that, then what you're going to end up with is a population of objects in the gas disk. The first things in the gas disk are just coplanar orbits. Second thing, ground down orbits. And then third thing are star formation in this disk. Okay, so those are the objects that are going to end up in the disk. So when you add gas, a couple of things can happen to the objects in the disk. I'd say gas does a couple of things for you. It's good. One, it accelerates mergers. So if you take a field binary that will take a Hubble time to merge, if you slap it into an AGN disk, you can merge it in a mega year, okay, depending on where you put it in the disk and the parameters. So you can do these things quite quickly. It accelerates a lot. You also accelerate binary formation. Okay, so this is a channel for making binaries in the disk. And the reason is basically the gas mass dominates the mass of the objects in the disk, and so gas torques dominate the motion of the object. The problems with this AGN are relatively rare. Okay, depending on who you talk to, 1%, 10% of galactic nuclei host something like this, relatively rare. They are small. We're talking about something that's maybe a parsec, maybe 10 parsecs, depending on who you talk to. And they have a finite lifetime. So whatever acceleration you want to happen needs to happen in a small area, in a relatively small number of locations in the universe over the finite lifetime of this thing. Okay? Grandon orbits. Okay, so essentially if you have orbits that are at moderate inclinations to the disk, as they punch through the gas, their orbit will tend to get ground down into the plane of the disk. Yeah, yeah, essentially you're trapped by the disk.
That's called grandon.
Yeah, yeah. So with this model, I think it's fair to say that you would end up with LIGO rates, given all the uncertainties, somewhere from insignificance, so order, insignificant to explaining everything, gigaparsecs per year, right? 10 to the, oh, sorry, yeah, 10 to the 2. So, you know, the thing that I want to open up to the floor here is discussion about how we can bring this down, how we can come up with something that's a lot more realistic.
Can you put the back of the envelope for that upper limit? Just it seems like the small, rare, finite lifetime is going to be so many hits.
Right. So Brian's estimate is on the order of 3. I'm pointing to Brian here. Brian's estimate is on the order of 3. But then if that's assuming a standard IMF, if you make it a top-heavy IMF, you've got an order of magnitude that you raise this by. So you're not 100, but you're like 30.
But the mass, again, most of the mass in the central region of black holes is at most 10 minus 3. It's probably much, much less than 10 minus 3 of galaxy mass.
Right. So. Right. So, yeah, if you want to fish out your rate calculation. Yeah, so. There we go.
That's assuming that a significant fraction of the stars and galactic nuclei formed in very dense AGN accretion disks.
I agree.
So there's another bunch of.
So I mean, doing it in my head, I would have gotten maybe 0.1 as my starting point, but maybe Brian can explain how he got to 3.
Right. Yeah. Oh. Yep. I can.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So I think, so the thing is that also there's going to be, so there's going to be solar mass black holes in the nucleus that weren't formed necessarily in an AGN disk, right? So you have things that are going to be brought in from, you know, it's not like you can harvest the entire galaxy because the dynamical friction timescales are too long, but you extend your reach somewhat for bringing stellar mass black holes into the galactic nucleus, and you can sort of say, you know, around Sag A star, you know, like how many, you know, how much additional mass might there be, you know, how many stellar mass black holes could you hide in there, and sort of use that as some kind of proxy. And then you can also say, and this is, I think, the time scale, the delay time is actually a really important thing, right? It doesn't matter so much what the supernova rate is today. It matters. It may matter much more what the supernova rate was at Z of 2. And so if you have some reservoir that you're currently burning through right now, you can, you know, obviously then maybe there's some time scale issues. But that's...
The supernova rate cancels out, right? Because it's just the stellar mass.
Yeah.
transport binary to end up in this or not?
Yes, the binary would end up, so so the binary should end up in the disk. Basically, the argument for why it accelerates binary formation is if you have a couple of singleton black holes. So,
this is going to work. How does it not work for all the other cards we see?
We want to talk to you on a specific topic.
Yeah, I think for Brian's model, yeah.
I have a potential point to damp the enthusiasm a little bit, actually, because the rate of accretion on the central black hole will be also increased by a factor of 3 to 5. We have done simulations of that, and we didn't switch on the mass spectrum yet, actually. I mean, it's an interesting situation, but you also get more stars, and there's a flow of stars through the disk to the central black hole. So the question is, where's the balance, you know?
Right, so there's a couple of things that LIGO could see or not see that can rule out this model. So this model would predict a wide range of Q. There should be lots of, there should be oligarchic mergers, so large things forming and merging with small mass objects, but also equal mass mergers.
How large? Why?
Q 10^-2 to 1. Something like that. So 10^-2 to 1. We should also see things like neutron star black hole enhancement, because those mergers are also going to occur in the disk, right? We should see bursty encounters. Let me explain what I mean by that. So LIGO limits on bursts could be useful here. So the deal here is for objects that are coplanar, that are born, that have orbits that are coplanar with the arriving disk, you'd expect some fraction of them to be retrograde compared to the motion of the disk gas. So some fraction of the encounters in this disk should be retrograde versus prograde. So very high relative velocity and a scattering event. So most of those should be single burst things. I don't know if LIGO can say anything about that. If you see a very bright single burst, maybe it's something like that, but that's something that I think LIGO should see.
What about excentricity?
The gas should typically damp eccentricity for binary formation in the disk, so you should expect most of them to be zero during the active stage of the AGN. When the AGN dies, so you come to sort of the final point, right, this finite lifetime. When the AGN dies, as the gas, as the mass of the gas decreases, then tertiary encounters could pump up the eccentricity of a binary that's trying to merge, right? So you could, like, there are possible higher eccentricity events that you might get in this scenario.
I mean, if you have those single encounters, though, the possibility always was they would capture right around 10 hertz, and then they would still have that enormous eccentricity by the time they hit the LIGO.
Right. I think that the velocity of these bursty encounters, that relative velocity is going to be so high that I don't think capture is not the most likely thing. I think it's just going to scatter.
Understanding of star formation in this environment is very poor. It does seem to favor, you would agree, maybe high mass IMFs. This is one environment where, at least theoretically, you might form thousand solar mass stars and have, you know, very massive black holes form.
Yeah, I would also. Yeah. So this to follow on Elliot's point. There should be no hard cutoff in the mass with this model. So if you see large mass If you see a 1,000 solar mass object, yeah, this is how you do it. Right. Yeah. Right, with three events. Yeah. Right. It's what we didn't see. Right, how many, right, what's the rate that you would expect? Right. Right. So what's the rate of formation of a 1,000 solar mass object in this? Yeah. Right. You'll have a power law of mergers. So where are they?
Like, just to make the point again clearer, I mean, as long as the disk is there, there will be a fast migration of these objects to the
Okay.
So this is actually, I think, the danger I see. So this, but when the disk forms stars, then everything may get interesting when we have only stars left.
So, so our original understanding of sort of accretion disks, I think, was that they acted as a conveyor belt, and so everything that's in the accretion disk essentially ends up on the supermassive black hole. The migration time scale depends on the torques provided by the wake of the object that's moving through the disk, and so you end up with torques from gas in the wake on the exterior to the orbit, and gas in the wake interior to the orbit, you end up with two large numbers. Depending on the difference, you can migrate in the disk, or you can migrate out in the disk. So depending on your favorite AGN disk model, if you have a disk that puffs up as it gets hotter in the interior, the gas torque will change, and you'll end up with zero torque orbits. So I'd refer you to Gillian Bellovery et al. 2016 on migration traps in AGN disks. So essentially there are zero torque orbits that these things should pile up at, and that's where merges will typically happen, I think, in this scenario.
There, with respect then to relativistic corrections, I don't have a full answer to that, yeah, but
sure.
Yes, I agree, yes.
Essentially, as you build up enough mass at the migration trap, you'll start to carve a gap in the disk, and then type 2 migration of the resulting stuff there can start to move things in, right? But it depends on your AGN disk model. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say it depends on what you think the AGN disk model does, but for sort of reasonably plausible locations for the surface density change, then the gravitational wave time scale at the migration trap is much longer than the AGN disk lifetime. And I forgot the number, but it's long.
So also I would add Lisa should see this population, right? Things that form at a migration trap. See these objects. Yep. So correlation with AGN. With AGN and right. So, I mean, one of the other interesting sort of fun problems to work on is what survives the AGN disk. So once the disk goes, so in the same way, when you make planets, right, planets outlast the disk, you end up with these masses orbiting. So you'll have objects in this model that survive and get another go around. So they'll in turn be able to merge with new objects in fresh disks. Yeah.
Difficulty to believe in the model that they will all peacefully pile up at the migration trap and then wait to form everything which we find interesting. I think that there will be some, like in planetary systems, there will be some scatterings and orbit crossings, and even
right.
more here we have a more chaotic
system. Right, so this is why I'm outlining fun problems to work on, right?
Exactly,
yep.
yes.
I think something we don't understand is how, as the disk profile changes, how effective gas damping is going to be at those scatterings. Yeah, that's definitely something. Oh, right, yeah. Yeah. Our Drake equation is far less well parameterized than your Drake equations, so, you know.
So I'm actually surprised your error bar is so low on your estimated rate.
I was trying to keep it, you know, not totally ridiculous, right?
So in our incarnation of this with Nick Stone, we were envisioning a scenario where the black holes were formed in an accretion disk that was feeding the black hole. And we were imagining the binaries were formed as binaries, and then they formed in the gaseous disk, and then they just get driven together by the same gas source, the various drives. And so in our rate, the way we parameterized this was sort of a Drake equation. So we have a local growth rate of black holes in the universe. And of that, some fraction, in growing the black hole by a certain amount, some fraction of the inflowing gas goes into stars. Is binaries, and of that, some fraction is in black hole mass. And then this was divided by the typical mass of an O star. And so what you get is if you put in, I forget what we normalize things to. We figured out some binary fraction that for a typical distribution of separate centimeter axis to actually merge, and then I think for a standard, I don't remember if we took a heavier standard IMF, but we said that about 10% of the IMF was in black holes, and then this gives you the three. So our motivation here was, at least in some models for self-gravitating disks that Todd Thompson earlier worked on, it was sort of hard to form, to feed the black hole in the AGN disk without forming a comparable amount of stars. And so we were arguing that this F star as a border unity. But that's only sort of disk, like large-scale disk AGN feeding, and that may not be the predominant way that low-mass black holes are growing.
Right. And I would add that we have yet to calculate a rate from for these populations
yeah,
one and two.
One channel,
right.
And then there's black holes around that are then sucked into the disk. Beyond those forms and tipping that way.
Right.
Sorry,
what is the number of AGN in a gigavoltaic?
Sorry, this is the local volumetric rate of black hole growth.
But how many AGN do you have in
that number?
Yeah, it's folded in.
You have quite a few, yeah.
But don't assume some rate of AGN to quiet black hole.
I think that's just a measure. That number is a measured number. We know the rate of which black hole.
Just through
right.
Luminosity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So for every gram of black hole growth, you grow 10 times as many stars in a self-crafting disk.
So Brian, does this model of the AGN luminosity has such a strong peak at around redshift of 2 to 3? Do you predict that we have a huge peak of the signals around those redshifts?
I guess you would. Yeah. That's what you're saying. We didn't add that to our list.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry, just like your star formation. For every gram of black hole growth, you do a gram of star formation?
Gram of star.
Okay, so it's 1:1.
Yeah, if you take this, this is normalized to 1.
Yeah, I thought you said 10.
I was just saying, if it's 10, you can make it 30.
Yeah.
Right.
But 10, I would have total.
Okay.
So there's a lot of work to do, a lot of fun problems to work on.
Sorry, I have just one question about this retrograde probate. In the other scenarios, maybe except for the dynamical, you know, global cluster, consider not favorable the case of retrograde?
Hmm.
I mean, in the standard scenario, even in the tidal law, you would exclude the retrograde.
Yeah, I think this is a unique prediction for this channel. But the problem is, I mean, talking to Dan and Duncan. Yeah.
Should I assume that it's...
So anything formed by...
If we find the retrograde, okay. If we found the retrograde case, which...
At least bring in retrograde.
Which effect we have in any of the other...
Yeah, it will happen, but pretty rarely, because you have to, you know, pick three vectors and get them all.
No, but just one up and one down.
It's one up and one down.
Or maybe both down, I don't know.
Yeah, unless you could, you already know you could get that from kicks, or if you got one supernova kick that completely flipped the old element.
Yeah, completely flipping is really hard.
Yeah, you wouldn't realign it. Yeah, you wouldn't realign it back up.
So one additional thing that we haven't really thought about too much is the spin prediction. We don't know if AGN disks don't last very long, then you can't really change the initial spin of the black hole by that much. So assuming they're accreting at Eddington, so. Depending on the population that this thing comes from, so for coplanar orbits, you'd expect a random distribution spins, right? So, you know, if the object is accreting at Eddington, happens to start off retrograde spin, then, you know, in 40 mega years, congratulations, it's at zero spin, right? So, you know, I don't know that we can say that much about the spin. There may be a preference for spin alignments, but again, you know, that's something that we need to work on.
Another interesting problem is that they have so many black holes sitting inside the AGN disk, they're all accreting at such substantial rate.
Yeah, so this, what's really interesting is you get Right, and I was talking to Andrew earlier about this, and so far simulations of, it's very hard to include radiative feedback in these simulations. So from accretion onto the objects in the disk. Yeah, please look.
This crane, the seed line will be much higher. Right, 200, again, the rates at 130 hertz would have a strength 35 times higher than what you just saw.
What about the bridge?
If it was. Yeah, so then you have to play that game. So if it were seeding and if you replace,
Redshift is an issue.
Yeah, redshift is the lowest setting. It's a messy, you know, it's a standard calculation we do where we basically plot, you know, the distance you can see and the redshift is, and I think I
you want to get
the last slide, my fault behind us is for Cosmic Explorer, so.
Microphone?
Yeah. I was just randomly thinking, because if you in these scenarios where you get to higher mass black holes by merging smaller ones, you know, every time you merge, you double the mass, but you'd always be dominated by the more massive ones. Yeah. Okay.
But those become less likely, you're more likely to kick them out.
Okay. Right. So there's some probably.
I mean, there are claims from spectroscopy of AGN that the metallicity.
Oh, sure. Sorry. Do you want to? And then there you go.
The question was how high is the metallicity in these regions? Several.
Yeah.
And there are claims. I mean, that's what I would feel comfortable. There are some claims of 5 solar. So that's a very interesting summary.
Yep. That's right.
And Mesa will crash.
Bill isn't here, so that's...
So you may have a more top-heavy IMF, but a much smaller fraction may actually form black holes, right? So it's sort of this
right.
competition.
Right, yeah, which way?
A much smaller fraction is the star.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome.
Okay.
Yeah. Wrap up? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.